This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation. Welcome back to the NBA Team Podcast, only here on placetobenation.com. I am one of your co-hosts, Andrew Reich, and I am joined by my regular co-host, Adam Murray, whose voice is kind of back.
Kind of, but I'll still turn into Brian Pillman by the end of this, don't worry.
It's kind of like The Rock. You're back, but not really.
It'll be interesting to see how quick it goes.
Yeah, I think you'll last a little while today.
Okay, you know? I hope so. I hope it wasn't too bad last week. I hope I was at least, you could still hear me.
Well, judging by the maybe one or two tweets that we got back after we did the most recent episode, I think we did okay there, which is par for the course. That's actually maybe one or two more than we normally get.
Look, we're actually getting tweets now? Wow, we're put on up.
Well, you're not on Twitter. Like I keep saying, you still have the dove in the cage that goes across the country.
I'm still going on smoke signals.
And so, like I said, if anybody has any questions, especially after this episode, where we might post a couple of opinions about what you think of some of the picks that we make here, I'll get more into that later. You can go to our Twitter handle at PTBNBAteam, placetobenation.com. Obviously, a lot of good stuff there that you can read, some podcasts you can listen to of all different types of different things. But this is the NBA team, and we're going to be talking about the regular season. Because finally, Adam, the worst thing in the NBA has come to an end, and that is the regular season, where at least I'm told by every media pundit in the country for the last 6 months, none of this actually matters. Now, do you really agree with that at the end of the day, that the regular season is kind of like the hors d'oeuvre to the playoffs main course, or do you think there's more takeaways that you can have from the regular season than just, oh yeah, it's only good for your seeding in the playoffs?
No, of course. This week, right now, you tell the Pacers, tell Brooklyn, tell New Orleans that the regular season doesn't matter. Why are these teams even fighting then for these last positions? It's this final week what defines, what sets you off to the playoffs.
Yeah, but do people really remember those last 2 weeks of the regular season for the most part? Unless there's like you remember when Milwaukee had that big meltdown in 2002 and they missed the playoffs and the Raptors got that spot. And I'm trying to remember a couple others, like the Lakers trying to get into the playoffs when Utah was duking them out with them and Kobe tore his Achilles. Like there's a couple of them that stand out. But outside of that, does anybody really remember the prodding that goes on with trying to get the certain seeds in the last 2 weeks of regular season?
No, nobody remembers it. You know, nobody remembers what happened last year. But the point is, this season, people know whether you backed on in and you went like 3-7 and somehow made it, or you were on fire and you were 8-2 and you got in. You weren't even supposed to be there. Mm-hmm. So there's a big difference of whether you're in on fire or just in to be like, oh, we barely made it.
Yeah, and maybe we'll just kind of generalize this before we get into the specifics of our main topics, and that is, was there really like a general story or maybe one overlying storyline that kind of came out of this season that kind of dominated most of the regular season, whether it be one team, one player, maybe a certain happening that kind of like when you think of this regular season, that's the first thing that comes up in mind?
To me, it was a lot of overreaction. Mm-hmm. It started with week one with, oh my God, the Cavaliers aren't going to go 82-0. And then just, you know, Houston is mortal and San Antonio is mortal and Oklahoma City isn't as good as we thought they are. And it's just like a lot of like every week, it would seem like the playoffs started the next week. It's just like, nah, you got like 50 games to go. Nah, man, it's All-Star break. Nah, man, it's the trade deadline. We still got things to figure out. It's just, it seemed like every week was just do or die.
I think the main theme that I kind of noticed, and it's been noticeable for the last two or three seasons, if you look at the scoring average, is that maybe it's just me because the best teams, like the Warriors and even in a way the Dallas Mavericks. They're so good on the offensive end, but it just feels like scoring has really exploded in the NBA. Did you kind of get that vibe?
Oh yeah, because everybody just shoots threes now.
Yeah, the three. Maybe that's kind of like the crux of it. The 3-point shooting. You know, the All Star game. We had 100 3-point attempts, which is insane.
Yeah, it's all it was. You have Steph Curry breaking Steph Curry's 3-point record again, and it's just everybody's just shooting threes.
Yeah, and so maybe that's the main thing I'm talking about, the increased number of 3-point attempts, whereas everybody at least averages 23-point attempts, even the lowest of the low. Like the Memphis Grizzlies, the Charlotte Hornets, they average at least 18 3-point attempts a game. Now, whether they make them all is different depending on your efficiency. Speaking of efficiency, we're actually going to get to the top of that one because we're going to be talking about end of season awards, just kind of like you give out to any other regular season. We'll be talking about some of the ones that they actually do give out in terms of hardware in the NBA, like the MVP, the Coach of the Year, the Defensive Player of the Year, the Rookie of the Year. And we might kind of pick a couple of others that aren't necessarily awards more than they are notables, and how we feel was like maybe the best move, the worst move, maybe the biggest disappointment, but we're going to have some fun with it. We are going to get efficiency wise into maybe what is the most important award of them all, which might be marked depending on efficiency if you're a real stat nerd like that. And that is the NBA's most valuable player. Now, this one usually is kind of, usually it works itself out by the time we get to the last few months of the season. LeBron has won it 4 out of the last, I believe, 6 years, and twice with Cleveland, twice with Miami. Derrick Rose won one in 2011. Kevin Durant won it last season. This season, LeBron's in the mix, but it feels like he's sort of trailing. He's kind of like playing what's the third place award in a horse race? Is that show?
You could just go Olympics and bronze.
Yeah, I could go with the bronze.
What are we, horse racers with this Kentucky Derby?
Well, I was trying to look at it like, you know, nose to nose, you know, down the stretch they come. But, yeah, probably going for the bronze here if we're going with kind of the Olympic, so to speak, with the MVP race. And the ones that are fighting out for gold and silver are probably James Harden and Steph Curry. Let me go with your pick first and see, Adam Murray, who is your pick for the most valuable player?
I said Harden on day one, and I'm not changing it now. He has done nothing to show it is not his season. Steph Curry, you know, he's hitting down like an insane number of threes, and he has to be close to like 50% right now, if not at 50%. But it's just like, no, Harden has just been, from day one, even when Dwight Howard's gone and everybody else gets injured, he's coming in every day and he's just putting up 25 points a game.
He's likely to win the scoring title. I think it's him neck and neck with Russell Westbrook right now, even though Curry had an offensive explosion in one of the last Thursday night games before the playoffs start against the Portland Trailblazers. I don't have the numbers in front of me right now. I apologize, but I believe Harden is in the lead over Westbrook. But it's very tough because if you look at the three-point shooting, James Harden is the lead in that. Steph Curry is first in three-pointers made. His three-point field goal percentage is better than Harden's. Steals-wise, even though Curry is high, James Harden is not that far behind. In terms of free throws attempted, Harden is way ahead of Curry. Offensive efficiency, they're neck and neck. Assists, James Harden's had a career year. Curry's had a career year, and he's in the top five. It's really, really hard to just pick one over the other right now.
I had no problem. You're probably going to be like, oh, Steph Curry's better because he had a good last 2 weeks, and that's all we remember.
Well, a lot of people are name-dropping the 1990 MVP race where – and it still surprised me to this day because I remember the 1990 season, and Magic Johnson won the award. Even though he had a great year, they didn't do well in the playoffs, but he won it over Charles Barkley and Michael Jordan, even though Charles Barkley had a lot more first-place votes than Magic Johnson did. The reason why people are bringing that one up is because they think this race might be about as close as that one, because even though there are guys that win the award over like superstar players at the prime of their career, like LeBron when he was in Miami, Shaq when he was with the Lakers, at the end of the day, when you look at the voting tally, it kind of turns into a bit of a snowball effect, and the guy who's in the lead gets the most first place votes, and the runner up winds up a good like 80 votes or maybe 50 votes behind. This one's going to be close. I think the winner might only win by about 10 votes or 10 points.
Yeah, it's going to come down to politics too, and like, there's already, you know, chit chatter about, you know, Mark Jackson wouldn't vote for Steph Curry, and it's just like, come on.
Mark Jackson says a lot of stupid things.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's down between these two. I think everyone admits that. All the Russell Westbrook fans can be like, no, he's done. He didn't play the full season. He had that, you know, month where he was on fire, but it's between these two guys.
That's what, and I was kind of alluding to mine, but my pick would be Curry. Best player on the best team. Transcendent season in terms of three-point shooting, in terms of offensive efficiency. Just the highlight reels alone, you could probably make a case for him. Harden is a highlight reel too, with his, you know, with the ankle breakers and the and all the 40-point games. How many 40-point games he's had? Like what? Like 7 or 8? Like it's some ridiculous number of 40-point games he's had. And he's had 2 50-point games with the Houston Rockets in the same season. No player in the history of the Houston Rockets, including Hakeem Olajuwon and Moses Malone, has ever done that. So he's already stepping into history now. Whether or not that means he'll actually win the MVP award, we will soon find out. The one interesting thing about Harden is that I think the Warriors are okay with whoever they get in the 8th spot, but there's a chance that James Harden might win the MVP and he might not even get out of the first round of the playoffs.
That's, you know, these are regular season awards. We're not, whatever happens in the, you know, look at the playoffs. You have people like Chauncey Billups winning the playoffs MVP.
Yeah, but you know what that means, though, is that say for example, Harden wins the award, or if he's voted to win the award after, you know, they make the votes on April 14th, and they get, let's say they get a wind up with a matchup with the Spurs. Well, you know they're going to announce it early in the event that Harden gets eliminated, because you want to have him have that moment at his home, on his home crowd.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe we might see that where if the announcement goes a little later than expected, then maybe we get an inkling that it might be Curry that's winning. A lot of people feel like the consensus is leaning to a little more towards Curry. But this is more of a Gore Bush thing. It's not as much like an Obama McCain thing where like, the leading candidate like wins in a landslide. This one's going to be very tight. I did want to bring up a few other considerations. We talked about LeBron James. You mentioned Russell Westbrook. Statistically unbelievable year, but the team has struggled even at his best, and I think that's hurt him. Anthony Davis, efficiency-wise, probably better than all of these players, but he's been hurt a lot. Chris Paul has quietly had a great year.
He really has, and it's a shame where you could have such a great year and really be so overshadowed, not only by the not dysfunction of the Clippers, but just by two crazy performances.
Yeah, and Marc Gasol, who we might talk about in a different award.
He was good. You know, Marc Gasol, he's...
Well, he never got hurt. You know, he played most of the season, even though his points per game is tame. And rebounding-wise, I think he's actually being out-rebounded by Zach Randolph. But defensively, he's their linchpin, and he's the best player on a team with Hets having one of its best seasons ever.
Yeah, but being the best player on the team doesn't mean you're the best player of the league.
No, that's
just
true.
Just put together a solid season for himself.
Yeah, and LaMarcus Aldridge, who played through that broken thumb, and still racking up ridiculous numbers for the Portland Trailblazers, who won their first Northwest Division in a very, very long time. We'll be moving on to Defensive Player of the Year. This one's a little weird. This one is the one that, to me, kind of goes by the statistics a lot more than the MVP award does. The MVP award, a lot of it goes into intangibles, like, well, how much of an impact did you have on your team in terms of wins and losses and stuff, whereas with Defensive Player of the Year, it really just comes down to how good did you rebound? How good did you block shots? And how good were you at stealing the ball? Who is your winner here for Defensive Player of the Year?
I just gave you a shout-out and said Anthony Davis. I can really – this year there hasn't been that dominant guy that, you know, that Ben Wallace, Tyson Chandler, like –
Is it because of the dictation of the game, like I was kind of mentioning with the explosion of offense? It's hard for defensive players to have an effect on the game?
Really? It sort of becomes that way. And it's just like – if you could give it for like a 1 month span, it would be like Hassan Whiteside would be the defensive player of the year because he went crazy for, you know, January and February. But it's just like, you could sway me to like DeAndre Jordan because he has, I think he's averaging like 15 rebounds a game or something.
Leads the league in well, no, actually, it's Andre Drummond who leads the league in offensive rebounds, but DeAndre Jordan's right behind him.
Yeah, okay. You could, like, you'd sway me for Drummond. You could say DeMarcus Cousins. It's just like, naming the first team, all defensive team, I think would be easy. Naming the defensive player out of that group would be hard.
You picked a guy that is leading the league in blocks, and Anthony Davis. You know I love AD, and I'm very glad that you passed that olive branch to me. But I'm gonna have to break it, and I'm gonna have to go with the guy who's actually leading in a different category, and that's steals, and that's Kawhi Leonard at San Antonio Spurs. Now I do have to go mention this with the, you know, the precursor that, yes, I do know that Leonard has missed up to 20 games this season with an eye injury and a hand injury. But, dude, you were just talking about guys that don't have an impact throughout a game defensively. Kawhi Leonard is one of those guys that can definitely do that. Every time I watch him against a really good team, like say the Spurs have a game that they really need to win from, every time they have a really great offensive player that they're up against, they put Kawhi Leonard on him, and that guy has, like, the most miserable game. You know, he makes life miserable for him. He's so great at stealing the ball. He's a good help defender. He always just seems to be there to make the right play for San Antonio. You know, I think it's weird because it's kind of like the same thing that's happened with Jimmy Butler. We're so enamored with his improvement on the offensive end, in terms of both Kawhi and Butler, that we sort of forget how good they are on the defensive end.
Yeah, but, you know, just being that, you know, like that Bruce Bowen, oh, he was, you know, defensive.
He's better
leader,
than Bruce Bowen.
But I'm just saying, Bruce Bowen put up, like, no numbers ever. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you know, you look at this, you look at the box score, it's like, why is he playing 40 minutes?
A defender and a three-point shooter. Nothing.
Yeah,
nothing
that was it. It's just like, he didn't get too many rebounds. He didn't do many steals. He was just like, what? He was on the floor. Just like, huh? But, you know, like I said, I could be swayed to any pick.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I'm going to bring those up with the considerations. Marc Gasol with the Memphis Grizzlies. He's won it before, I believe, but that was in 2013, but I don't think he's going to get it here. Rudy Gobert, the Utah Jazz. This is mostly bigs. Rudy Gobert, the Utah Jazz. DeAndre Jordan for the Los Angeles Clippers, like you mentioned. Serge Ibaka of the Oklahoma City Thunder, still on the shelf. Andrew Bogut, who's had a really good defensive year for the Golden State Warriors. He's sort of their cleanup man inside. And then, surprisingly, Tim Duncan of the San Antonio Spurs, Old Faithful.
Yeah, Gobert, just starting off with him. No, because he'd hardly play the beginning half of the year. Mm-hmm. All because you have a few good months doesn't mean, you know, you should be the player of the year, even in that conversation. As for, like, you know, like, Ibaka, he took a step back this year, I think.
I think he took a step back on the defensive end when they really
asked him to do more on the offense, yeah.
Yes, I agree with that. I got to defend Gobert there because – if you look at – because there's this one synergy stat. I don't remember what it was. But it was opponents' points at the rim against specific bigs. And Rudy Gobert was by far the most effective defender at the rim compared to most of his contemporaries. And for a guy in his second year who only started after March or after February, to be able to do that is unbelievable.
Yeah, but you know, again, it's just 2 months. And he had, you know, spent a lot of time on the bench before that, so he has fresh legs.
Okay, now we're going to get to the coach of the year. Now, this one, the criteria on this one is always kind of funky because, you know, it's one of those ones where the really great coaches who actually win the championships or the ones that have the star players that lead a team to a 60-win season, they never get enough credit. And then a lot of times they give the award to a team that isn't doing so great, but the perception out there is that, well, the coach is doing a great job this year because that team wouldn't have been any good and somehow they're overachieving. So the coach gets rewarded for the players overachieving, which to me doesn't make any sense. Greg Popovich won it last year, and I agreed with it. I'll give you this example. I think Phil Jackson's only won Coach of the Year once.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes no sense to me. you know?
Yeah, but, you know, with his teams, how much coaching are you really doing?
Well, that's the point, is that I think that sometimes we can lose interpretation of, well, you don't have to coach that much in order to have a good team play great. You know, and I don't know. I sort of go back and forth with that, but I do, because I do think you need the guidance. I do think you need that, and maybe the effort to make a great team play great is just as hard as it'll be for a coach to make an average team play well. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's hard to define that and to compare the two.
But, you know, like as this year, it's just not exciting because everyone knows it's going to be, you know,
it's gonna
Kerr,
be
Budenholzer.
So Steve Kerr and Mike Budenholzer for the Atlanta Hawks, who are the clear top.
Yeah, they're the clear ones. Like, in theory, I would say, like, Jason Kidd, who, what could he do with that team? That team was supposed to be, you know, god-awful and worse and worse and worse. And
so you're in the camp of coaches who get average teams to overachieve.
Well, yeah, because you're, you know, it's your coach of the year. It's not just because your team won 60 games. I think Golden State would have won 60 games with Jacques Vaughn at the helm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they could just have no coach and still do it.
Well, if they had Mark Jackson, they barely won 50 games.
But that was last year, and they shored up their bench this year with you know, key signings like
improvement from Bogut and Draymond Green.
Well, health from Bogut.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He actually stayed healthy for the first time, I think, like in
seven years. He's defying logic for sure.
Yeah, pretty
one
much.
Day at a time. yeah, you know, we might split the baby here. I've got Mike Budenholzer. Who do you have?
It'd be, you know, Budenholzer for the East, Kerr for the West, whoever you want to pick from those two.
Man, Budenholzer's job was so tough because it's not just all that stuff that was hovering over them from the racist comments with Danny Ferry and the owner who eventually stepped away. But it's just that the team, they didn't really make a lot of main additions. The only one they had was Tabo Cephalosha, and he unfortunately broke his leg in the in that nightclub incident in which Chris Copeland of the Indiana Pacers got stabbed. Man, thoughts and prayers for everybody involved with that, except for the stupid hoodlums that made the stabbing. Did they even arrest anybody in that incident?
Yeah, they arrested a couple people.
I mean, swear to God.
You know, the weird thing about the Atlanta thing is they haven't sold the team yet.
Mm-hmm.
They got, you know, the Clippers went in like a week. You think there'd be somebody like, yo, I'll give you $1 billion. Here you go.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it being dragged out so long?
I just think I don't want to drag out all that. Because you know what's weird? We have this large, like, chunk of, like, Atlanta sports fans that work at SplaceToBeNation.com. And the moment we say anything mean, I can hear them. I can almost hear them in the chat rooms getting mad at us.
But this isn't mean. It's just...
But I'm about to get mean because the Atlanta fan base is so flat. And I think these owners are scared to walk into a situation in which they buy a team and the fan interest just dies within a matter of like 2 years after buying the team.
You can always move the team. Nobody says you have to keep them there.
You got it. Well,
what owner is going to turn down like 50 or was it 100 million to?
But would Atlanta be willing to do the new arena, which they likely will because, you know, I think their fan support is strong. I think their fan support is good enough that they would build them a new arena if they asked for one. You know, the Milwaukee Bucks are in that process right now.
Yeah, they're you know, going through designs and,
yeah,
you know, good for Milwaukee. It's a nice, tiny little city. I've been there. Mm-hmm. They have a lovely zoo.
A nice, tiny little city.
But
I mean, I think Atlanta's fan point is good enough in which they'll, like, okay, we'll give you a new arena. But in terms of, like a lot of it's going to come down to what happens in this playoff run. Because if they don't show up, if it doesn't feel like they're there – present, like if their presence isn't felt for these home games, I think a lot of people are going to start crapping on the Atlanta sports fans and saying, you see, you can't support even a great team. You know, they really need to fan up. I hate to use that word, but they need to fan up.
There's always hope. It's just, I don't know what this situation, I don't know why, I don't, you know, the way the values are, I don't see, again, why someone would just come in just to snap them up, just to have them. You could always resell the team.
Yeah.
You could always flip it in a couple years.
They were originally in St. Louis. Which I, from what I've heard, the rumors from Tickling the Ivories is that they're going to be losing their football team in the next 2 years.
Who was supposed to move there?
What? Where?
To St. Louis, and the deal got nixed.
Are you talking about the NBA or the NFL now?
Maybe it was hockey?
Well, in the NFL, the rumor is that...
Oh, Memphis. The Grizzlies.
Yeah, when the Grizzlies were moved out of Vancouver, their main ones were Pittsburgh, Memphis, New Orleans, and St. Louis.
I mean, the St. Louis guy was going to buy them, but mm-hmm. But the league nixed it. And
yeah, Eisley bought. Well, I think Eisley was the owner when they relocated, and that's when they made the decision to go to Memphis. And New Orleans came up short. And then the next time a relocated team popped up, it was the next season with the Charlotte Hornets. And then that's when New Orleans got the Hornets, who eventually became the Pelicans, and so on and so on. And, you know, that's just the way that's the circle of life. But the rumor I was talking about the NFL is that the St. Louis was going to, like, do a swap where the Rams go to that one of those – was going to be one of the teams that goes to Los Angeles in that brand-new arena that they're building out there in Inglewood or whatever. And the Raiders would go to St. Louis, which to me makes no sense. But – But going back to the whole Atlanta thing, we totally lost track already. But Mike Budenholzer, I just think I think his job was a little tougher because they didn't really add a lot of pieces, and he really had to build the team from the inside. Whereas with Steve Kerr, I felt like it was a little ready made for him. Like he just had to
really
take this
all Atlanta does is shoot threes.
Yeah, but they're good at building the offense to shoot threes. Whereas Golden State, it's like almost a new version. I hate to make that comparison, but it's almost like a new version of Michael and Pippen, where it's like, look, you got the two best offensive players. Good luck trying to stop them, you know? Yeah. Whereas with Atlanta, they got to work on it. You know, they had to work on it all season long in order to make that offense work, in order to make that team work. You know, I just think that the coaching part there was a little more integral in their success than it was with Steve Kerr and the Warriors.
Yeah, but, you know, again, I think we'd both agree it's sort of a two-horse race.
Yes.
Other trendy choices.
Other considerations, like you mentioned, Jason Kidd of the Milwaukee Bucks. Brad Stevens of the Boston Celtics. I mean, that team should not be good. Let me get you 2 cents on Brad Stevens.
I don't know what he's doing. I have never seen, like, you know, an entire team filled with bench warmers, like, overachieve as this team has.
Yeah, that is the definition of an overachieving team. All season long, too. I mean, yeah. I never felt like they really, like, coasted at all, like the Nuggets did. Like, I never felt that way about the Celtics, you know?
No, it was just always, yeah, they don't have talent. That's why they can't win.
And then Dave Jager of the Memphis Grizzlies. Same kind of situation as Mike Budenholzer. Same team, but they did better than they did the previous year. You had any comments before we move on?
No, I believe we both agree. Pick one of the two.
Okay, rookie of the year. Now, the 2014 draft was pretty highly praised in terms of potential, but then there's that word again, potential. You know, and in the first year, you don't always see it click. And this year, to be honest with you, we really didn't. Jabari Parker seemed like the runaway at first. He tears his ACL. Hopefully, he comes back and he's better than ever. Andrew Wiggins struggled to start with the Minnesota Timberwolves. He was originally obviously drafted by the Cleveland Cavaliers. He was part of the LeBron James or the Kevin Love's trade. So he's in Minnesota. He struggles early, but then he really comes along as the season progresses. Who was your rookie of the year?
I have Wiggins by a lot. I have Wiggins, and that is it. There's nobody close to Wiggins.
But here's my question there. Does that mean Wiggins is just that much better and that he's going to be great, or is it just because of it's compared to what his competition?
For one, last year's draft was so overhyped by ESPN.
Well, it was bad. It was just a bad draft.
It's just like, but it was just like, oh, this person could be this. It was just, you know, it was the year of comparisons. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, you know, you're all one and doneers. We don't know what you can really give. Oh, but this is the year. This guy's going to be great. And you're just reporting on it so much, people bought into it.
Just to clarify, when I said bad, I meant the 2013 draft. I was misconstruing what, because I'm skipping the years. I was thinking the 2014 draft.
2013 didn't have any.
2013 is like the worst of the worst. 2014 draft was good, but I do get your point there. So you keep going.
But 2014 was just like, you know, he's an unknown kid from Australia. He's totally the next Steve Nash. And, you know, Marcus Smart, he's, you know, totally the next, you know.
If I did a true ranking, Exum would probably be like barely in the top 15. Barely.
He's not up there at all, but it was just all like ESPN hype on most of these guys. People are bashing Wiggins because the team was so bad. They're like, oh, his numbers are terrible, and statistically, he's the worst win ratio of all time. It's like, well, yeah, because there was nobody with him.
No, they were the worst defense in the league, for sure.
Minnesota didn't know whether they wanted to tank or, you know, injuries just left and right, and there's really not much you can do when you have Rubio go out for months at a time, then Pekovic go out for months at a time. Then, you know,
didn't Pekovic get a staph infection or something like that? Or am I thinking differently? It's or something with his elbow?
I don't know what, but he had some foot thing, and then Kevin Martin was gone, and then Chase Bunninger was gone. Just the whole entire team was just...
Yeah, Kevin Martin had a very random, like, late March, early April 37-point game, if you didn't notice that.
Yeah, and it was just
those
like,
are the ones that you remember, like, when at the end of last season when Corey Brewer got the 50-point game. Those are the games that I always remember the regular season, like the games that nobody cares about, but they stick out like sore thumbs as time goes by. Those are the games that I remember. Kevin Martin getting 37 points for no apparent reason.
And like Wiggins, it was like, you know, he had no – he was being, you know, played in spot situations, sort of played out of position. Like, well, are you the go-to guy or is Kevin Martin the go-to guy? You know, who's taking all these shots and who's, you know, he didn't really have a fit. And once he started going along, like you watch him play, it's like, okay, by far he's there. It's just his team is horribly, horribly bad.
Yeah. And it was a bit of a litmus test because when he came in, it felt like, okay, you know, Wiggins is good, but Anthony Bennett was, you know, was like the number one pick the previous year. And Zach LaVine is like this great athletic player. He wins the dunk contest. So a lot of people felt going in like, well, we'll see which ones sink or swim. And it was even though LaVine had a solid rookie year, it seemed like Wiggins was definitely like at the top of the crop, not just for the Minnesota Timberwolves, but probably for most of the rookies. He was like the leader in scoring. He was one of the leaders in rebounds. He was one of the best in steals. He was just a really good player. And in the best games, in the games where he played his best and his jump shot was falling, he looked great. And also against comparable small forwards like LeBron James, like even a Blake Griffin, I thought he played pretty well. I didn't think he embarrassed himself.
Well, yeah, and it's just sort of, again, finding his position. What was he, a big two? Is he sort of an average size three?
I think he's like a solid three. I think,
yeah, and, yeah. You know, don't forget, he in Kansas, he never took over the games there either. He's just a very laid-back guy, and people are sort of expecting, like, oh, well, he's the next T-Mac. They're like, well, he has to be in his prime T-Mac, averaging 25 out of the gate. Not
well, in college, you know, his athleticism was a key to him being a really good defensive player. The problem is, like we had already mentioned, he's potentially an elite defensive player on one of the worst defenses known to man. So it's hard to judge him.
Yeah, it doesn't help if you're playing defense and everybody just blows by you anyways because nobody else is.
Exactly.
But, you know, it's like you can't say, oh, well, Mitch Roddick is, you know, oh, well, he should be up there because he plays 25 minutes a game on the best team in the league. Well, yeah, that's because you're, you know, you're playing with the second team. You're already, you know, 27, 28 years old. And is he 27 or is he 25?
I believe he's 25. That's Doug McDermott's spot anyway. He only didn't get it because he had the knee injury.
Yeah, and that's really working out well for them. But it's just, you know, no, you can't give somebody who plays 20 minutes a game as Pau Gasol's backup as the MVP, as the rookie of the year, or Nerlens Noel, we mentioned as a dark horse.
We both agree on Wiggins. What we disagree on is that I thought Noel was a close second, whereas you did not.
I don't think there was a close second, but if I have to put number two, I think it would be Noel.
He was leader in steals, leader in blocks, and rebounds among the rookies, which is really impressive. He had his career high recently with a 31-point game. Offensively, let's obviously, very raw. Very, very raw. But rebounding-wise, block shot-wise, I mean, he is really good.
He's good on defense. The problem is that team is just really bad as well.
I think we found a team that's worse than the Minnesota Timberwolves, and that's the Philadelphia 76ers. Obviously, there's a team that's worse than both of them. We're not even going to mention them. But that's we might get to the worst of. We might have to talk about them a little bit. Other considerations, Elfrid Payton, who had two triple-doubles this year. You mentioned Nikola Mirotic for the Chicago Bulls. Jordan Clarkson of the L.A. Lakers filling in at the guard spot for Kobe Bryant.
Meh.
He was impressive, though.
Second team.
And what about LaVine, the guy who won the slam dunk contest? Decent numbers.
Second team. It seemed like there's only 10 rookies who really played this year.
And other rookies you kind of liked that kind of like you think about like a Rodney Hood or I'm trying to think off the top of my head a couple of the other ones.
Hood.
I want to say Schroeder, but Schroeder was a second year player.
Everybody, Marcus Smart. Mm-hmm. He just needs to make good shots. Yeah. Yeah. Well, his problem is he still wants to play hero ball. Mm-hmm. He's like, I'll just sit back and do a 30-foot, lead fallback three. It's like, you can't do that anymore. It's not going to work.
Well, he got that weird game winner where he was just kind of like under the basket and it just kind of fell to him. It was very odd. But, I mean, good for him. What about Kostas Papanikolaou for the Houston Rockets? Kind of a random one, but he had a good year.
Put in solid minutes. And
yeah, there's a few others, but I'm not thinking of them off the top of my head because they really, honestly, none outside of Wiggins and maybe Elfrid Payton and Nerlens Noel, none of them really, and Jabari Parker, none of them really stood out. It was just kind of just another year for rookies. No Blake Griffin, no John Wall, no LeBron James, no guy that's just like, wow, that guy's going to be a star. Like, I didn't feel that way.
There are a couple of flashes. Like, you see Nurkic. It's like, okay, this guy can be something. But it's just like little glimpses. And those who had him, got injured in week one or...
Yeah, hopefully we get a little lucky next year. A bit of a tease for our draft stuff. But, I don't really see it there either. Let's go on to the sixth man of the year. This one's a little weird too because there are teams that turn guys into six men because for that one particular season because it works for whatever reason and then they go away from it. And then there are guys that are just career six men like a Jamal Crawford, a Manu Ginobili who are always in the mix. Crawford's won it twice. Ginobili's won it, I believe, once. But I don't think either of us are going to go with those two this year, right?
No.
Okay, who you have for sixth man of the year?
I got Lou Williams. He has been the one bright spot in Toronto. The team sort of middled out like we sort of predicted. And he has been the definition of a six man. He comes in, I think he's averaging 15 points a game. Just he comes in to shoot. That's what he does.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like a J.R. Smith, but now he's starting in Cleveland.
Yeah, wasn't he leading the Raptors in scoring at one point? Almost, or he was behind DeRozan.
I think it was behind DeRozan.
It was just crazy. He was scoring as many points as Kyle Lowry was. And Kyle Lowry was like playing majority minutes, He came into the Raptors in a nothing deal where the Hawks just wanted to unload him so that they can make room to sign Cephalosha. And it wasn't like Lou Williams was like a bad fit for Atlanta. He did well in Atlanta, but he had just come off of an ACL injury. Late in the season, and then he turned. He basically had a new lease when he went to Toronto and just played his best basketball. He just balled his ass off.
Yeah, that's why he's my vote for sixth man.
Mine. I'll actually go on your end of the spectrum. In terms of location, and I'll go with Isaiah Thomas. Currently, the Boston Celtics began the season with the Phoenix Suns. Now, I have not been looking at the rosters, so I do not know if Isaiah Thomas has been starting for the Celtics, but he did have a 34-point game against the Detroit Pistons. So if he came off the bench and scored 34 points, that is fucking impressive.
He is not starting.
That is amazing. That is why he is my sixth man of the year, hands down.
But that's, again, for 2 months of work in Boston. Mm-hmm. What did he really do in Phoenix other than, that situation was just bizarre to begin with.
He was good in Phoenix, though. I was pining for him to start, and then I realized, no, wait, this works. This is him as a sixth man actually works. And then he went to Boston, and I liked that deal from the beginning. I thought the Suns made a huge mistake. And he comes in, and he's like the I think he's the leading scorer for the Boston Celtics.
You know? Yes, he is. Yep.
You know, he's like, I think Olenek's hanging around there somewhere, you know, maybe Brandon Bass, but definitely Isaiah Thomas. He has been like the spark plug for them ever since they turned that deal in at the trade deadline. And since he got there, I don't know if it's going to play out that way if he stays in Boston for an entire season next year, but he has definitely been the reason why the Celtics have improved this season. And if only for that, I would pick him there. You know, he's just a really good help out guard. That's how I see it.
Yeah, he's just, you know, again, we picked basically essentially the same person, somebody who's like 5'10" and just will shoot threes all day.
Yeah, Isaiah Thomas is a lot shorter than Lou Williams, though.
Lou Williams is not tall.
No, but Isaiah Thomas looks like a bowling ball.
Wow.
So we're split there, like most of these. Let's go to most improved player. I've never been a fan of this award because I think it's a bit of a backhanded compliment. Because you could take it for a couple different reasons why I don't like it, but a lot of people can take it as, well, you were bad last time, and now you're better than bad. Or you used to be mediocre, and now you're really good, so we're going to reward you for it. And it's just kind of like, really? Is this how we're judging people now? So you're basically admitting that last year you sucked?
Yeah.
You know?
I agree. I'm not a fan of this award either.
But the award actually exists, so we're going to have the discussion here. So who's yours?
I don't really have one this year, so I think I picked Jimmy Butler just by default, kind of.
Well, in terms of consensus, he's probably going to win.
You know, as for what he's done, it's like, okay, I guess, but, you know, he basically took his contract year and said, I'm going to be a max player, and he's making Chicago pay.
And you know who the other guy is that's going to probably turn himself into something close to a max in a contract year, and that's Draymond Green of the Golden State Warriors. That's not my pick, though. My pick, again, I'm going to have to like fight for him, Rudy Gobert of the Utah Jazz. You know, because here's my opinion of it. What's the difference between going from something to, like say, an Anthony Davis, like going from something to something else? And what's the difference between that and then doing with Rudy Gobert, where you go from nothing to something?
Yeah, but he was buried on the bench behind Cantor, so it wasn't like, you can't say, well, you're the most improved considering you played 5 minutes last year and now you're playing 30.
Yeah, but you and I kind of saw this when we saw the FIBA World Cup, when he just shut down the Gasol brothers. And we were like, man, there's no way a guy could do that on his own. This must be just like an anomaly. And it just turned out, no, Rudy Gobert is just a really good rim defender, you know?
Yeah, he, like I said, he's good, but it's just,
I feel like I'm just fighting for him too much.
You know, maybe Al Horford, who was out last year with the injury.
Well, that, you know, there's no comeback player of the year in the NBA. There is one in the NFL. I think there's one in Major League Baseball. But in the NBA, there is no one. You know, they should call it the Derrick Rose Award because he's always coming back. oh, that was mean of me. Other considerations. Oh, wow, we totally forgot this guy, Hassan Whiteside. Would you consider him the most improved player?
No, because he wasn't in the league last year, was he?
Barely. Like, he would make a 10-day contract here and there, and then he'd be gone.
Yeah, that doesn't count.
Giannis Antetokounmpo of the Milwaukee Bucks.
Yeah, you could say he's improved.
But then it's kind of like Coach of the Year where you forget about the great ones because you want to reward the little guys. But the thing is, like, for example, a guy like Kyrie Irving, like, he went from being pretty good to being really, really good. Anthony Davis went from solid, like good rebounding numbers and solid scoring numbers to great scoring numbers and great rebounding numbers. Like, that's a big jump.
But that's just natural progression, I think.
Yeah, but the jump is just as large as going from an average player to a good player. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, you know, like I said, it's hard. Like, what jump from tier to tier? Like, at what point do you start comparing that length of the jump and say, well, this guy did more in order to get to the, from here to here than this guy who went from being an average player to a really good player? Like, it's hard to judge that, You know, I think the best way I saw it was when Paul George won it. I think that's like the best example of most improved player. He went from a solid rookie to a really good player within a matter of like 2 years, you know?
Yeah, I guess. But again, we're both not fans of this category, so.
No. So we're going to be.
You can't blame our lack of enthusiasm.
Well, we're trying to get the enthusiasm, but, you know, you're not a big fan of this one, but I had a pick, but you can kind of like tell me why you weren't really thinking about this one too much. And that's best overall, best game, best single game, like between two teams. Why don't you really care about this one?
Cause, there's just, it's the best game. Oh, wow. It was a good game. Like, I don't know, because it's very arbitrary. You could say the best game came down to, like, you know, example, Celtics beat the Hawks 89-88 with an Evan Turner last-second, you know, layup. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the best game because that was a crazy ending. Or it could be, oh, this was the best game because Kyrie Irving scored all those points. It's just so arbitrary. There's no way to defend it. There's no way to...
Like, when the season's all over, the confetti's falling. Like, where would the best regular season game fall, like, among the playoff games that are played out? Like, it would probably... I think there's a couple of them that would stand out and I would put in the top 10, but that would probably be at the most 2 out of the 10.
The thing is, if you ask 10 people, they'll have 10 different answers.
Mm-hmm. That's true too.
There's no consensus. That's why I'm like, I'm not going to pick one because.
And the intensity's different. The intensity's different until you get to the last 2 weeks, like we were just talking about. You know, I had to pick one because I do kind of like this category, and I had to go with the one on February when the Warriors went to Atlanta and played the Hawks, when the Hawks were pretty much at their best and the Warriors were streaking again. And that was just a great game. It went into the high 100s and or the like the 120s, and it was just a really, really good up-and-down game. And I just feel like I wish basketball was like that all the time. You know, but is that going to be better than any of like the really pivotal playoff games? Absolutely not. Like, exactly. I would watch those games all the time, so I get your point of view there, that regular season games, you couldn't pick one because they're all sort of innocuous by the time you get into the playoffs. So I understand that. But we do like this one, and that is best solo performance. Did you have one?
It took me a while to pick this one because I'm like, well, what do I do? You pick, you know, the obvious one with, you know, Kyrie scoring however
57.
Many. Yeah. Do you go for that? Do you go for Russell Westbrook's triple, double? Or do you know, do you find like a really, like a player out of nowhere who just had a crazy stat line? Like, where did this come from? And I went with Hassan Whiteside's 14 points, 13 rebounds, 12 blocks in 25 minutes.
That was against the Chicago Bulls on a Sunday game on ABC.
Yes, back in January 25th.
Yeah.
Only 25 minutes on the court, and he filled up that stat sheet that much.
He had had a couple of good games when he got called up before that, but that was like the red alert. Like, man, Hassan Whiteside has arrived, you know. Now, is it like Linsanity? A little bit. Like, he might fall back by the time once coaches figure out where he likes to try to hustle for rebounds, and then they try to ice him out. It'll be harder for Whiteside once people have a playbook on him. But he's really, really talented, and he's really, really long-armed.
Yeah, and, you know, well, like, the thing with Whiteside is, you know, yeah, like when said, he will fall down, and, you know, it'll just be like Birdman. Birdman had that, you know, crazy year. Where does it come from? Then he just became an athletic guy off the bench.
And it comes down to situation because, you know, Birdman is one of their centers, but he's not a great rebounder. You know, LeBron left, so they needed a rebounder in the paint, and they basically told Hassan Whiteside, the Miami Heat did, okay, you're a rebounder. Get all the rebounds. And then in this game, he was just an interior force for against a pretty good Chicago team. I do remember in the interview, he said, I was just trying to get my 2K rating up, which I think is like a classic quote that we're going to be remembering for years to come. Great performance. I do like that pick because it's sort of a buried treasure. It's one of those ones where you catch it on YouTube on the side, on the right, and you're kind of like, wow, that guy had that game, and you kind of click on it out of curiosity. I have to go with the obvious one because it was just such like a – it was like we mentioned when it happened. It was such like a transcendent social media – like orgasm moment, and that was Klay Thompson going crazy on the Sacramento Kings when he scored 37 points in the third quarter, finished with 52. I know that overall, if you watch the entire game, Klay wasn't like an incredible presence like Whiteside was, like Irving was against the Spurs when he scored 57. But there was just something special about that third quarter when Klay Thompson went bananas.
Yeah, that's he did not. That one quarter is probably the best quarter of.
It's the ultimate heat check. Like, it's when you heat check forever and you don't stop.
Yeah, pretty much.
Basically what they call, the young guys call going NBA Jam. That was mine. A couple others. The Anthony Davis had a pretty good stat line against the Nuggets. I think he had over 40 points, over 15 rebounds, only like two turnovers. We talked about Irving with the Spurs. Kyrie Irving had another great game where he scored over 50 points against the Portland Trail Blazers. Mo Williams, of all people, had a great game against the Indiana Pacers. If you really wanted to go innocuous, that's the one you should have picked. Mo Williams when he was with the Timberwolves.
Yeah, Westbrook had his string of games.
All of his triple doubles. Yeah. It's hard to pick one, but there was one in particular against the 76ers where he went for like 49, 15, and 16 or something like that. It was like a crazy, crazy stat line. I'm thinking off the top of my head, and I'm not remembering. There were quite a few other really great games. We talked about James Harden having all those 40-point games, a couple of 50-point games. And then there's some random ones that sort of show up, like that one game where Nerlens Noel almost had a quadruple-double, Evan Turner having two triple-doubles, which is like random as could be. But I like our picks. I think those are solid. All right. Best player in a supporting role. Now, I had to kind of preface this with a description. A guy who kind of plays in a complementary role in this season for the team that he plays for, not necessarily in his career or, as an achievement award, just more as...
So, yeah, it's just the best old guy award.
Best sidekick. Like, what player has kind of done the best job kind of, underneath the tie? Like, who do you think has done a good job?
For this, I went with Vince Carter, who he knows he's no longer has much of the tank. So he just said, I'll be the eighth man in Memphis. I'll be that, that little spark off the bench. I'll give you 20 solid minutes, and I know my role now.
Mm-hmm.
That's, taking a lot less money, a lot less minutes, just to be a team player.
Yeah, but he hasn't had the same impact that Jeff Green has.
Yeah, but Jeff Green was a trade, so.
It's true, but it kind of comes back to the definition of, complimentary player. Like, do you think I don't think Kyrie is necessarily a complimentary player. Like, he's good enough to be a star of his own. Mine might be controversial in that case, but I think Pau Gasol has done a great job with the Chicago Bulls. Double-double machine. He had a 46-point game against the Milwaukee Bucks, but it just feels like with all the talk about Derrick Rose and all the talk about Jimmy Butler being improved as a scorer and leading the team in scoring, and then, Joakim Noah being such a good assist man as a big man, I just feel like people forget about how well Pau Gasol's played this year, and that's why I picked him.
You see, it could just be A, I didn't understand the question, which even after your explanation, I still don't understand it. And B,
that's not a first.
Gasol is used to being just that guy who comes in and does his thing. He's used to the Kobe and Dwight Howard, and he just comes in and puts up his numbers. He's not there to be the flashy star of the team.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I mean by that really is like what player has kind of gone under the wings and done a good job.
I don't think he's gone under the wings. He's just doing his thing. He's just not the, he's not the flashy focal point. He's like the Tim Duncan, nobody cares about Tim Duncan.
Because in that case, you can't even pick Draymond Green because everyone's talking about how well Draymond Green's played. So you can't pick him.
Well, he's just the... he's the overrated, underrated guy.
Mm-hmm. If I really had to kind of just sneak one in, I would probably say Tyreke Evans of the New Orleans Pelicans. I think he's had a really good year, and no one's talked about him.
Yeah, but he's just having a good year. He's not.
Yeah, but him playing well was pivotal, especially when Jrue Holiday went out.
He's playing well, but the problem is, with so many injuries, you still don't know if he's a sixth man or if he's a starter because.
His role has never been defined.
Because nobody's role has been defined because somebody's always out.
Yeah, you're always filling in. I definitely know.
So, you know, you can't just give it to a guy for having a good year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Gasol never tried to be in the limelight to begin with. Mm-hmm. The same thing with Duncan. It's just like, oh, it's Kawhi Leonard and look at Tony Parker.
It seems like the whole Spurs team are complimentary players, like all of them.
Yeah.
It's just weird. That's just how well that system works. You can do the same about the Atlanta Hawks team, but we might kind of hint to that a little later. Okay. Now we've been happy. We've been talking about all the good things and rewarding people for doing a great job. Now we're going to have to slap some demerits down and some pink slips for people who didn't do as good of a job as we hoped they did. Hate to kind of turn that smile into a frown, but it's gonna be necessary. We're gonna have to brave through it here. We're gonna start here with most disappointing player overall. Who is the most disappointing player of this season, Adam Murray?
First, I'd have to go with Dion Waiters.
That was who the starters picked. The starters on the NBA TV, they had the worst. They had a banner for worst of the year. Their first last year was J.R. Smith. This year was Dion Waiters.
Why? Like, he, you know, for one, he spouted his mouth off in Cleveland. Like, oh, I'm going to be a starter. It's just like, no, man. If you'd stay quiet and do your thing, you could have just, you know, ridden this wave. But nope, you had to go. You know, you had to go speak up. You get sent to Oklahoma City, and you tank even worse there. Mm-hmm. Like, he has shown nothing like redeeming of like a fourth pick
in Oklahoma City. If it's crazy, but it feels like he regressed. Like, yeah, it feels like he got worse. Yeah, he had a couple of decent games when he sprung out with Oklahoma City at first, probably just from the excitement of being in a new place. But it felt, because a lot of people were thinking, well, you know, LeBron being there is kind of holding Dion back because he can be a scorer. But if you watch Dion, he's always ready to catch the ball, but no one wants to give it to him because they know what's going to happen. He's going to miss the goddamn ball. You know, he's going to miss the shot. And it's just, he's just such a gung-ho type of shooter, and he can't shoot. He's like the opposite of Steph Curry. The moment he gets the ball, you know the ball's not going anywhere. You know, and it's just. He is the definition of disappointing this season, for sure. You know, I get your point. Did you have one that was close, though?
I wouldn't say close, but I would just have to say maybe Paul Pierce, because not disappointing as, oh, man, he sucks, but disappointing as, wow, he really doesn't have anything left in the tank.
Yeah, but you can say that about a lot of, like, Kevin Garnett, even Kobe Bryant. Sometimes he would have games. I think he had one game where he scored no points, you know?
Who, Kobe?
I believe so. I think it was against the Spurs.
Oh, that's a shame.
Or maybe he had six. Like, I mean, just,
you know,
like,
but it's just feet. Like, you know, it was, you know, the sign was like one of the best. You know, it was like, oh, it's a great signing. He's gonna be that complimentary piece. He'll give that,
the missing piece. Yeah,
yeah. He gives that locker room leadership, and it's just like, well, he came in and, well, he didn't really do anything because he has nothing left. Mm-hmm. And he just sort of dropped off really fast.
Mine is kind of the obvious one if you look at the Twitterverse, and that's Lance Stephenson of the Charlotte Hornets. You're not as surprised about him not being great as I am. I just thought he would do well in a place like Charlotte where he could be that do-it-all guard as a combo guard alongside Kemba Walker. I don't know if it was the injury to Kemba Walker, which took him out for a while, bringing in Mo Williams. But it just seems like nothing has clicked with Lance in Charlotte since he got there.
Well, he seems to be the scapegoat for the reason the team is doing bad. People are just ready to jump on him, and I don't really know why. Like, you know, looking at his, you know, people are forgetting, like, Al Jefferson. I don't know if he has any like anything left in his legs, period.
Yeah.
He just looks like he's 80 years old, just hobbling around.
Yeah, but that's been his game since he tore his ACL in Minnesota, to me. Like, he's always kind of been that way to me. Like, kind of a low center of gravity type of center, big man.
He's in that way, you know, just miss after miss on draft pick. And has his numbers really been, like, what did you expect from him? Let me just ask you that.
From Lance Stephenson.
Yes.
I was expecting over 15 points, probably about 6 rebounds, which I think he's hovering around, and I was expecting at least 6 assists. I thought he'd be a great distributor. whereas Walker would be more of the scorer, but it's been the other way around. When Lance gets the ball kind of dies. And I was sort of surprised by that. Maybe it's because he's given up on the coach, even though the rest of the team hasn't given up on the coach, which has put him in the doghouse. But
okay.
Yeah.
I got you. You were looking for him to become that all-star that everybody thought he would be.
Exactly.
Let me give you these two numbers. 2 years ago, in Indiana, 8.8 points, 3.9 rebounds, 2.9 assists. This year, 8.2 points, 4.5 rebounds, 3.9 assists. Those numbers aren't – he's not like regressed to the point where he's just horrible. He's putting up the same numbers he did 2 years ago before his last year's –
Yeah, but that was right before he hit his spark in the playoffs in 2013.
Yeah, that was just one little spark, and he's just, you know, it's sort of one of those, he'll give you what he could sort
of. Lance. He's like John Starks, you know. He'll give you back in the New York Knicks days. He's great, and then he's terrible, you know. And he's so volatile, like you just don't know what you're gonna get out of him.
It's just, I don't, you know, I wasn't, I didn't think he'd be that good to begin with, and I was sort of right. So I can't say he's a disappointment because he's been pretty much what I expected him to be.
I've always been a fan, and this is why I like Tyreek Evans and I tried to pine for him. I've always been a fan of those, like, big body guards that are able to kind of bully little guards, which there are more of in the NBA now because of all the shooting and all the ball movement, needing more guards on the floor. I feel like a bigger guard, a wider body guard that has good ball control with his hands because he has large hands, I think those guys can have a real impact on the game, and I just like them because they're more of an old school type of player, and I feel like Lance could have done more in Charlotte this season. It just didn't work, and I can't explain it, but I think you hit a lot of good points there. Let's move on to most disappointing team.
Actually, one more quick point about him. Who else on that team was going to score? All you have to do is sort of play any defense on Lance. Gilchrist ain't going to give you any points. Biombo and all the other failures at the power forward aren't going to give you any points. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, you can't expect one guy to come in and all of a sudden start to shoot 50 when the rest of the team can't score.
Well,
that was their problem.
And that's the thing, too. The philosophy wasn't there. You know, they were a horrible scoring team last year. They're a horrible scoring team this year. You know, their rebounding is good because of Jefferson. And I'm missing on the other big that they have there. I think Zeller, you know,
he's had
a decent rebounding season. Outside of that, terrible. But, you know, they're a defensive-minded team. And, you know, Lance was on a defensive-minded team in Indiana. I thought he could kind of, like, shore that over and do what he did in Indiana his last season there and do it in Charlotte. And it just didn't happen. Just a really rough transition. And, you know, when you have a new arrival like that, it's so fresh. It's like, oh, wow, this is the guy that might do it. And it just doesn't work out. Most disappointing team. I think this one's pretty easy.
I gave it to Denver.
I agree. Denver Nuggets.
They had the potential, I thought.
Not just because they're terrible and that they quit on their coach, which to me was kind of despicable, but it was just that they really could have been good. And I don't mean that in a snarky way. Like, they really could have been a good team.
On paper, they look good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess Gallinari's injury, he'll never be the same.
Well, he had a 40-point game, like, about 2 weeks ago. It's crazy. It was a very out-of-nowhere game.
Yeah, it was out of nowhere, but it's just like, overall, I guess he won't be that, you know, he's sort of plateaued, I think.
Oh, for sure. His best days may have been in New York. I hate to say that, but it might be true.
Could have been.
You know, he had a couple good years at Denver. Then the ACL went in 2013. That was the end.
That was it. You know, Ty Lawson, everybody still loves him.
Got arrested.
Fareed.
Did not play up to his contract.
But it's, sure. You know, but the it's. I wouldn't say he didn't play to his contract. He just never – it was just, like, so bullheaded, like, no, you're playing this way. We're going to slow things down. Well, I'm an energy guy. No, we're going to play slow. And he just didn't fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, I mean, maybe playing slow in terms of Brian Shaw as a coach, maybe that wasn't a great idea. But don't give up on your fucking coach. And then play hard after he's fired. You know, that's a slap in the face. That really is. And it's not necessarily a slap in the face of the fans. It's a slap in the face of the coach that came before the fill-in, you know, and it just rubbed me the wrong way. Did it rub you the wrong way as much?
No, because it had already gotten to that point.
Mm-hmm. When he was reading a book about how to communicate with millennials.
Yeah, really, if it gets to that point, like, you know, things should have been done before that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you have a runner-up, though?
Minnesota. Not because, like, they're disappointed, but it was sort of like a, like, you know, you what? Like, what are you going to do? You want to tank? What
they are. It's the Dennis Green thing. We thought who we thought they were.
No, but, you know, they traded for Thaddeus. You know, they traded their first round pick for Thaddeus Young. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, okay, so you kind of want to be competitive. Rubio got injured, killed the team. Pekovic got injured, killed the team. It's just so many injuries on that team. It was just sort of like, they never really got off the ground because
and Anthony,
they were.
Can we officially call Anthony Bennett a bust?
I don't want to because he hasn't been. He's been injured all this year too. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe if he has a full season, I could say yeah next year. But it's kind of hard when you're just injured the entire time.
I'll go east with my disappointing team, and that was the Miami Heat. Like I know that Chris Bosh had the injuries. But, you know, you had Whiteside who did well. And Dwayne Wade statistically did well when he played or when he felt like he wanted to play. But I don't know. I said this team was overachieving when we had the last episode.
I was going to say, you just said they're overachieving. How could they be disappointing?
Because they could have been better. Like, they really – they are better than that. Like, I just – maybe it's because I'm trying to stymie the LeBron effect on Miami. But when I look at that team, and they retained a lot of the same players that went to the NBA Finals 4 years in a row alongside LeBron, they kept Chalmers. They kept Birdman. They kept Udonis Haslam. A lot of these guys came back. They added Luol Deng, who's a good player.
Yeah, but
Roberts got hurt. I get that. Wade had some solid games this season. He had two 40-point games. It just seemed like they could have been better than being 8 games under 500, which is a massive disappointment.
But it's like, no, nobody wants Mario Chalmers.
But when we went into the season, we both agreed, like, Miami's going to be good. They're going to be in the playoffs. Now, I mean, they're on the outside looking in, man.
Yeah, but it's just, I don't know. It's kind of hard to say they overachieved and then they're disappointing at the same time.
Is LeBron – let's be honest. I don't want to make this like a conundrum on like the greatness of LeBron James, but does LeBron really hide that many weaknesses? Does he?
He kind of can.
Like in Cleveland, you feel the same way? If he left again and then they had K-Love and Kyrie and J.R. Smith, they'd be a 37-win team?
No, because they have a little more – because – if they go, so does Mike Miller and Sean Marion and the rest of
Mike
the bench.
Mike Miller has been like a no-show. Marion the same.
Yeah, but they still take up space. But I think they're better off because they have Mozgov, Love, and, you know, they're a different team.
Yeah. We might bring that one up in a second, actually. It's going to be pretty close. Most disappointing trend. This one's a little weird, but like, what's something that you noticed in the NBA, whether it be a player, whether it be kind of like a sequence or maybe a pattern that you just really kind of rubbed you the wrong way?
That everybody's embracing tanking. I don't like it, and
you need to explain though, because everybody says that every team tanks at the end of the season.
But you have the Knicks and the Lakers. Two of the sports cornerstone franchises having the worst years in the history of their team. Mm-hmm. And it's okay. Philly is, you know, like everyone says, it's running a Ponzi scheme. That's okay. People are getting angry at the Celtics for, well, you're not tanking hard enough because you traded for good players. And what are you doing? And why are you trying to win? And, well, you know, Minnesota, why aren't you tanking hard enough? You can't have 10 teams tanking and everyone being like, oh, just don't worry about it. It's cool.
Because you know what happens when you're tanking and there are 5 other teams doing a better job of being bad? You're the 6th worst team in the NBA.
Yeah, and you're not going to get better by getting the 6th pick.
There's two things about the tanking this year that bother me. Number one, it's this kind of like collective initiative by these teams to or a strategy to make to buy these fans into the idea of tanking, which I think is counterproductive. You know, Phil Jackson has these press conferences where he's basically saying, yeah, we might be losing, but it's all part of the plan. And the Sixers, it's all part of the plan. And it's like, dude, I almost want to scream at him and say, dude, you don't have a plan. Because after the season, you're going to rip up your team again because none of these guys are going to be on this team once you're successful. So what the fuck is your plan? You know, that's one part. The second part is if you're going to tank to get a number one pick with a guy who's like a surefire NBA superstar player. There is none in this draft. So what are you looking for? What light at the end of the tunnel are you racing for? That's what worries me about tanking this season.
Yeah, that's just a trend I don't like.
Mm-hmm. Is it more widespread? Yes. I just think that the teams have done a smarter job of making fans buy into the idea of tanking. Like they want to see their team lose, which I think is pathetic. But, you know, that's where we are. We're in a postmodern society where we want to suffer now so that we're better later. But are you going to be better later is the question. Mine is actually two. The 2016, you and I called it the capocalypse, when the salary cap balloons and everybody's worried about ending their contracts in 2016 so they get their big payday under the new salary cap rules as soon as possible. That it's not that it's bothering me. It's that we talk so much about it. And it's like, dude, that's not even next year. That's the year after next year. And we're sitting here talking about it while we're getting ready for the playoffs, when by the time we get to 2016, all these teams are probably not even going to be in the race. Like, that kind of bothers me. Mm-hmm. You have anything to say about that?
Oh, you have the big cap in 2016 and the strike of 2017.
Yeah, but should we be talking about it now?
No.
I mean, is it a big deal at the end of next season? Absolutely. That's the number one story. But this season, please forget about it and just enjoy the season. The other one... A lot of teams I've seen a lot of players this year roll their ankles on the court. I don't know why, if it's just happenstance where you hit a guy toe to toe and it rolls, or maybe the soles of the shoes are just a little too smooth, the rubber's too smooth, or maybe they're buffing the court too much, but it just seems like everybody's slipping around all over the place and they're just not pivoting and their ankle rolls. And a lot of teams have had guys sit out games due to sprained ankles. Is that part of maybe a plan for some of these star players so they can get more time off? Possibly. I don't think a lot of these guys are going to be taking games off in the playoffs if they roll their ankles, but it just seems like it's happening more and more and more.
I will take your word for that. I'd always just thought it was a commonplace thing. I didn't see a trend one way or another.
It is, but I feel like they're more severe, like the one Ricky Rubio had, where that was ugly. I mean, it took him out the whole season, for God's sakes. An ankle roll.
Yeah, that was pretty severe, though.
You know, it's just, I don't know, maybe it's just a random thought there. We're going to talk about the actual, like, player movement, some of which happened before the season began, some of them that happened midway through. What did you think was we'll talk about the signings first. What was the best signing overall that you saw this season?
Best signings were not originally thought so, but the way it came down, Stuckey and C.J. Miles were had for pennies on the dollar, because Indiana was, okay, we crapped out. We need to shore up our bench, so let's get some cheap people. And all of a sudden, C.J. Miles, $4 million a year, 4 years. Stuckey was a one-year veteran minimum deal.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Stuckey got, like, what, $2.5 million?
Nope, 1.2.
Oh, wow. They really underbought to get him. That's crazy.
1.2.
I didn't think he was that devalued in Detroit. That's nuts.
You know, they both put up solid numbers.
Oh, Stuckey had a great month of March. A great month of March.
Because you never know when it's time to step up, and these cheap additions have shown. Another one, Evan Turner. He's like $2.5 million.
We can rewind. You hated that deal.
Of course I did, but you know he's overachieving on that deal.
Mm-hmm. I can easily go with the obvious and talk about LeBron going to Cleveland. I'll skip that, but I'll go to another obvious one that people have kind of already forgotten, and that was that the Warriors not trading Klay Thompson and re-signing him to max money. That was smart. Could you imagine this team without Klay Thompson now?
It would be a completely different team.
Yeah, but, you know, this goes right back to one of the first things we ever talked about on NBA Team Podcast with the potential Kevin Love trade for Klay Thompson and David Lee that almost happened. It'd be a completely different team, but would it be a better team? Now I believe absolutely not. This team would be definitely worse.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't sure, but now Thompson is definitely going to be one of those star players that can really carry you. He could almost be a star player on his own without Curry, but he'll never be in that position because he's signed, sealed, and delivered for the next 5 years, and it's likely that Curry will get the max pretty soon too. He's still got a couple more years on a very low ball deal that he got like right after the lockout right before he had his breakout. It's unbelievable. The league MVP might earn $11 million a year. That's crazy. The worst signing.
Worst signing? I have two. Number one, Spencer Hawes going to the Clippers, as he pretty much killed the Clippers cap situation, which made them have to do all those stupid moves they did all season. Mm-hmm. And he provided nothing. Number two, people are like, oh, Lance Stephenson, because he's not that all-star that we thought of.
That was a low-ball deal, though.
That was a low-ball deal, but the other signing, they got Marvin Williams 2 years, $14 million.
Ooh.
And he's averaging career lows pretty much all around.
He is a career low. You know, every time I watch him, I'm like, this is like one of the worst seasons he's had. I'm like, wait a minute, that's every season.
You know, he's down to 7.5 points and 5 boards a game.
Still trying to shoot 3-pointers, that dude.
Remember
that story came out? They said, I'm trying to work on my 3-point game. He's like, dude, you shoot 20% from three. Don't work on your three.
Yeah, he's still shooting threes.
Oh, Lord.
3.5 a game. And it's just bad signing.
Oh, God. What a bad fit. That's a good one there. Mine was also a re-signing that happened in the summer. You know, I'm not as clever as you are, Adam, obviously. But Marcin Gortat getting 5 years around $50 million guaranteed, I don't know, man. Maybe he'll turn it on in the playoffs like he did last season. But then again, the contrarian in me says, well, that was a contract year, and now he's gonna kind of go back to normal. And I feel that's what I'm seeing out of Gortat in the regular season with Washington since he signed his contract. And I feel like once we get to like 2018, 2019, the Washington Wizards are going to look at that deal and go, man, like David Lee with the Golden State Warriors and go, God, why did we do that? Because of one good playoff performance.
Well, yeah, but you can't base a bad signing on year 5 and year 1. You know, his numbers are down.
Mm-hmm.
But that whole team is just strange.
Yeah.
Like, the whole team is just not doing anything right now, and
they're predictable in their strategy, but they're unpredictable in their performance. Like, you don't know how well they're going to play, but you know how they're going to play.
You know? Yeah, and I don't think it's his fault. And, you know, everyone's like, the worst signings were all like everybody pretty much re-signed got like the worst ratings. Mm-hmm. And it's just, there's really no need for that.
Okay, best non-signing move. You could talk about a trade. You could talk about a pickup. You could talk about pretty much anything that happened within the season. What was your favorite?
I had to, you know, I was trying to think out of the box on this one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because obviously I was gonna pick the Josh Smith getting cut and Detroit somehow being revived by that.
For a little while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, they got just revived, period. But I think it has to go with Isaiah Austin at the draft getting drafted by the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
That was just a classy move that you don't see any other league sort of do that.
Can you imagine the NFL doing that?
No.
Oh, yeah.
I can't.
You know, it's like Michael Sam, you know, he gets drafted and the NFL's like, well, we don't care. You're part of us now.
Oh, he was arrested for domestic battery. Oh, he's picked fifth and he'll shake hands and do a little cool hand thing with Goodell and... No, like you don't see, you know, the kid, you know, didn't know he had this career-ending disease, has to, you know, 2 weeks before the draft, comes out early, you know, sophomore, comes out early, doesn't, and just, you know, a class move by the league saying, you know, giving him some recognition.
I don't know if you get the same vibe. Maybe it's because we're so, like, more closely, we follow the NBA more closely than some of the other sports, but the NBA seems more familial. It feels like a family. Like, you know, not just in terms of the players in the league now and their relationship with the fans and, you know, their ability to interact and such compared to some of the football players and maybe some of the baseball players. I don't follow baseball that closely, so I can't say that much. But it feels like these guys are, even the legends, they all kind of round up together and help each other out. And I think Adam Silver, whose idea I believe it was to do that with Isaiah Austin, I think he has a really good touch on the pulse of what the fans want and what would be the right thing to do. And I like that one. That was a really nice, even though it was last season and it was, you know, before the season even began. I think that was a really classy one. For me, you know, I go to the actual transactions, and, you know, I'm going to need you to help me out with some convincing, because I have a few of them. The Grizzlies getting Jeff Green in a trade, the Heat taking Hassan Whiteside out of the D-League. One of them is also one that you mentioned. That was the Pistons cutting Josh Smith with that clause. And then the Cavs in January with their trades in which they got J.R. Smith, Iman Shumpert, and Timofey Mozgov, which basically saved the season. Which one did you like the most? I'll actually let you take my pick.
I like the Mozgov trade because...
Just the Mozgov trade or J.R., Iman, and Mozgov all together? You think Mozgov alone was that much of an impact?
Well, because he's the one that sort of started it. Mm-hmm. And unlike Kanter, they needed, you know, Kanter wasn't the missing piece in Oklahoma City. Whereas Mozgov, he's not there to score. He's just there to cover Kevin Love's bad defense. Mm-hmm. And the team got way better when he came in. Then, you know, you cut out Waiters and you get J.R. Smith, who just does what he's going to do. Not there to put up an attitude anymore. He's like, yo, I'm just going to shoot threes. I know it. You know it.
Yeah.
Okay, we know who you are.
Here's how we can differentiate him. The one with the Heat and Whiteside, that took, to me, honestly, a bad team into a mediocre team. Like a team that could actually be a bit of a threat. The Pistons, the same. I felt the same way about the Pistons when they let go of Josh Smith and they started playing like their ass was on fire. I felt like they went from like a really bad team to a pretty good team, like a decent team. The one that we just talked about with the Cavs and then the Grizzlies getting Jeff Green, that was the jump from being a good team to a really good team. Like I don't know how much of an impact Jeff Green has had on that team, but I do feel like it's had a major impact.
He's provided a spark, yeah. The thing with the Whiteside thing is it's kind of hard to give Miami any credit after you said they've overachieved and are disappointing. And B, you have, what is it, Tyler Johnson and Henry Walker, and even Beasley, equally great signings.
Well, define great.
They've paid nothing for them, and they're providing quality minutes and points.
Well, it's like that old phrase, though, looters in a riot. Like, at what point are we going to start to realize Miami is a bad team, and these guys are getting good numbers not because they're buying into Pat Riley's system and all that.
Because there's nobody else.
But because they're just bad. You know, I don't know, man. It's maybe I'm just down on Miami after being high on them last week. I'm such a fucking flip-flop, man. Worst move, non-signing. Worst one. Worst transaction. Or just worst move in general.
Worst move has to go with the Kings. The Kings were doing better than anyone expected. They fire Malone. The team just falls apart immediately.
Yeah, they didn't even need a couple days. Like, I mean, Ty Corbin is not a head coach. We knew this in Utah, you know, but for him to be the fill-in and then expect the team to do better under him rather than Malone, that's ignorant. I mean, I don't know how smart Vivek Ranadive or whatever his name is. I don't know how smart the guy is. But that was just like, dude, do you really think this team's going to do better under Ty Corbin? Now, they may have fixed the problem, you know, down the road when they hired George Karl. But then again, yeah, go ahead.
Now there's front office problems. And Vlade Divac's now your spokesman. And it's like,
Chris Mullin went to St. John's.
Yeah, Mullin gets run out and... Mm-hmm. It's just a mess there now.
And then DeMarcus Cousins doesn't like George Karl, and then there's all this stuff like, well, it's because George Karl is in this shoe camp, and Cousins isn't a fan of that camp, and it's, I don't know. Here's my one point about that in defense of Malone. There's a chance that Mike Malone, and people haven't talked about this, there's a chance Mike Malone did a better job than George Karl will do. You know, just because George Karl did a good job in Milwaukee and Denver and Seattle, it doesn't mean you're going to do a good job everywhere you go. I mean, well, I've seen great coaches go to their last stop in the 90s and stunk, you know, and it's not like it ain't going to happen again.
Yeah, but also at the same time, you have to take a while to get your players in. So how patient are they going to be when Carl's like, well, I don't like, you know, Rudy Gay.
If your front office is in disarray, how many moves can you make?
Exactly. It's just a lot, you know, the second worst move I would have to say is JaVale McGee. Whatever happened to him?
He'll be in China next year wearing panda shoes like he always
does. It's just like he got, you know, Philly's like.
JaVale McGee's going to be a star. He's going to be like Bob Sapp. You remember when Bob Sapp became a star in Japan?
Yes.
Yeah, it'll be just like that when JaVale McGee goes to like the Philippines or
like Philly is just like, we're gonna pay you because we can, but yeah. You're gonna, nobody else calls him. It's like, ooh.
That's amazing. I mean, there's a lot of players, like even Kendrick Perkins, who gets maligned for being a bit of a goof sometimes. Even he, well, not a goof in terms of like attitude, in terms of like level of play. He kind of gets frowned upon. But even Perk got a deal with the Cavaliers. You know, I mean, JaVale McGee got no phone calls.
Even Hassan Whiteside came back and, you know, he's starting to show his antics again.
I say to JaVale, do what Rasul Butler and Antonio Daniels did. Go to the D League. Start over. Start over. Work on your game. Start over. Try to
or go to China. Go to China, not get paid, and then
and win championships with Stephon Marbury. I mean, what are you going to prove there?
Well, he might just be one of those. He'll be cut in a month.
Yeah.
Be like, well, you know, maybe you should appreciate what you have.
Or pull a Josh Childress and get overpaid in Greece.
That could happen. You know, it's just one of those things where. Very odd. Nobody wants a 7-foot center who can actually play.
Yeah, well, it depends on if he. I don't know how much he can play anymore. Mine in terms of the worst move, the Suns blowing up their backcourt at the trade deadline. I still don't understand why they did it. I understand what happened with Dragic because Dragic felt betrayed because his name was his name was getting inked for different deals and he sort of turned on the team. But the Isaiah Thomas trade made no sense to me. You know, just letting that guy go and basically getting dimes for the dollar by getting they took on I can't even remember the guys that they took on in that complicated deal that involved Isaiah Thomas. I think one of them was Marcus Thornton. But
yep.
Dragic, you know, getting traded to the Heat, you know, they got a little bit in return, so I didn't hate that deal. But letting go of Dragic and Isaiah Thomas, and then basically selling Eric Bledsoe, okay, it's your team now.
I felt like they blew up the team.
You know?
I think by panicking and saying, okay, Brandon Knight, you're our guy. We wanted you all along. You know, like, what?
Not only that, restricted free agent Brandon Knight. You just went through all this mess with Eric Bledsoe, and now you're going to do it again with Brandon Knight?
Yeah, it's just like you traded for Brandon Wright, so you made an attempt, and then you just blew up your team, and then it's like...
Now, that move was solid. You know, getting Brandon Wright was actually not bad.
Yeah, that was the, okay, we're going to bulk up. We need size. Let's go for it. Okay, then let's just implode.
I just really
question marks.
And not only that, it ended them. It ended them in the Western Conference playoff race, and I think it may have ended it for good. Like I don't know if this team's gonna really revive themselves from that unless Brandon Knight is just able to prove next season, coming off of some injuries at the end, that he can do what he did at the beginning of this season with Milwaukee, and that's a stretch. You know, I think Jason Kidd is now getting a reputation now as just being a great point guard coach, you know, because he's every team that he's coached, the point guard or the backup point guard has had a great year, and without him, they've been terrible.
Yep.
You know, look at Sean Livingston in Golden State. He ain't turning heads. I mean, I hate to be honest with you, but Sean Livingston ain't doing great in Golden State. You know, the only thing people remember is that he grabbed Dirk Nowitzki's nuts.
He's been average, but he hasn't done anything. And, you know, last year, Phoenix just overachieved so much. This year, Jeff Hornacek just looks lost now.
Yeah. Okay, that's probably going to wrap up most of this. Do you have any other kind of takeaways that you want to add before we start kind of going into our roundup before we close it out?
No, I'm content with my choices. Your choices were also solid.
Were you surprised that we were really split on a lot of these things?
No. No, because, like, you know, like I mentioned, I was sort of digging in the crates for a lot of these. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to pick the same ones everyone else is going to pick.
Yeah, that's just you. You just like being the other guy, or that guy in the room.
Pretty much. I am the fifth dentist.
Wait, what?
You know, 4 out of 5 dentists agree.
I hate dentists.
I'm the fifth dentist. I just never agree with anything.
The idea of 5 dentists in a room makes me, like, want to fucking cringe. But we're just to give an update for the schedule. This episode is going to come out a little earlier than the others because we're getting ready for the playoff season, which is going to be coming up next weekend. So, well, to prepare y'all, we're basically going to be splitting some episodes. Adam and I are going to be previewing the Eastern Conference playoffs, and then I'm going to invite over on the NBA team podcast for another episode, my friend and a really smart NBA guy, Norman Rockwell. Not the painter. He's going to be coming in, and we're going to preview the Western Conference just to get everybody ready for the playoffs, because I think it's fair. I hate to, like, smush it in, but I think it's fair to, you know, the Place to Be Nation listeners and the listeners of the NBA team podcast that we get these previews out before the weekend starts. But, you know, it's just so weird because you look at the Western Conference, because we haven't really talked about the regular season as right now at this moment, but it's just weird that the Western Conference from the 3 seed down is just so up and down. You just don't know what's going to happen. And then same thing with the last 2 seeds in the East. We really don't know who's going to win those. Are you still sticking to some of your choices that you made?
Still going to go with them. I'm not going to.
Boston looks like they're
in. I'm not going to flip flop.
Boston looks like they're in.
Back to back against Cleveland. They need to.
How did they do that again? I said that last time, and I don't understand it.
I don't either. It's just they have
they're not even a rivalry team.
Weird. It's just the way it fell.
I still like Boston, and I still like Indiana. I like it. I like it. I like it. And then with the West, bold prediction, Spurs get the 2 seed.
Spurs are looking like the Spurs.
Spurs get the 2 seed, which guarantees that they'll play the Warriors in the conference finals instead of the conference semis.
Are you going to flip-flop and pick the Hornets now over the OKC, or sticking with what you got?
Thunder still get in.
Okay.
Thunder still get in. I'm not going to flip-flop yet. I've done a good job of that, doing that throughout this episode, where I said the Heat overachieve, but they're the most disappointing. But, okay, on behalf of Adam Murray, this is Andrew Reach. I hope you enjoy the regular season, but we still got some hooping to do, guys. Come on.